Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. As our president threatens retribution against trade partners who aren't playing fair, in his new book, our next guest reminds us that America's role in the global ebb and flow of goods is hardly innocent. Eric J. Dolan's Black Flags, Blue Waters recounts the rogue sailors who terrorized the shipping routes of the Atlantic and Indian Oceans, unnerving the superpowers of that time, and ultimately in some ways emblemizing the brash new nation to come. While the golden age of piracy was relatively confined in duration during the 17th and 18th centuries, it has an outsized influence on our collective imagination, spawning countless books, movies, theme park rides, and Halloween costumes to this very day. Eric J. Dolan, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks for inviting me.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. This part of today's show is pre-taped, so we're not taking calls, but you can engage with us on social media. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. You can comment on the post for this particular segment. Or on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Just use the hashtag GCL. So, Eric, how big is the difference between sort of common public perception about the what the world of pirates and piracy was like, thanks to, you know, popular fiction and movies, and what it was actually like?
There's a pretty big gulf. A lot of people romanticize what pirates were all about, and much of that had to do with some of the writing actually that occurred not long after the Golden Age. Some books that made them out to be larger-than-life characters, sort of going out at sea, plundering at will, having romantic entanglements. But it really took off with Treasure Island, and then in the mid 1900s, there was a whole raft of movies with Errol Flynn and Robert Newton and about Long John Silver and Blackbeard, and then that was added to by the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise with Johnny Depp, and all of them portrayed pirates sort of as good-looking, endearing, rakish rapscallions that were just looking for love and treasure and to drink on the ocean waves. And unfortunately, the reality of pirates is quite different than our romantic perception. They were neither endearing nor heroic characters. They basically were seaborne thugs whose only goal was to plunder ships of any nation and hopefully sail away with some treasure. And they often engaged in some really horrific behavior, torturing and sometimes killing their victims. So the image that we get from Hollywood and many fictional representations is quite different from what the pirates were really like. But of course, in abstract, it sounds wonderful almost to chuck everything on land behind, you know, leave your job.
Right, yeah, it's like being on the road.
On the open ocean. But it's not quite like that.
What was the end game? I don't know if this is an easily answered question, but what was sort of the end game for the captains, the guys that were trying to acquire all this wealth? Was this a means of comfortable retirement, or was this just fame and fortune, or was it a little bit of everything depending upon who it was?
A little bit of everything. It really depends on which period you're talking about. Before 1700, the book broadly focuses on the golden age of piracy from the late 1600s to the mid-1720s. If you look before 1700, we're talking primarily about the Red Seamen, the ones that went around the Cape of Good Hope into the Indian Ocean to attack Mughal ships or Muslim ships traveling between India and the Red Sea ports of Jeddah and Mocha. And those pirates came from the colonies, they plundered these ships, they brought back to the colonies much needed wealth and treasure, and many of them actually settled again in the colonies from which they sailed and lived relatively comfortable life. There were up to 40 different pirate ships engaged in that activity. But then the other segment of piracy that people are more familiar with, what took place in the 17-teens and the 1720s, is when pirates, they were no longer going to the Indian Ocean and attacking these quote-unquote infidels halfway around the world and then settling nicely back into their community life. Instead, these pirates were attacking merchant ships, American merchant ships, English merchant ships, and they had hopes of getting rich, but actually very few of them amassed significant amount of treasure. And by this time, the colonies and the mother country were so upset about these depredations of the pirates that they really had very few places they could repair to. They couldn't come into ports like Boston or Newport or Charleston because they were the enemies of all mankind.
Right, they were on the run at that point, basically.
They were on the run, so they still hoped to become rich, but what actually motivated them, some rose up and mutinied on ships where they had despotic captains. Others just felt that they were like gamblers going into a casino with hopes of striking it rich, but unfortunately, in the end, many of them failed to achieve their dreams and lived relatively short and brutish lives.
How much is known about the dynamic on the pirate ship? Because, you know, through the Pirates of the Caribbean and things like that, you sort of see the captain, and then he's got his crew, which are the lowly people, and then he's got his first mate and all that. Was that fairly accurate? I mean, how much do we know about that life?
We know a fair amount. That was fairly accurate to the extent that the captain was elected by the members of the crew. It was a relatively democratic process, and if the crew lost faith or confidence in their captain, they could depose the captain, which did happen on occasion. The quartermaster was sort of the second in command, and he was like the ombudsman on board a pirate ship, and he would handle any conflicts or problems that arose that weren't explicitly laid out in the pirate articles or the pirate code, which the pirates actually signed. And those articles determined the distribution of wealth, of whatever booty or treasure they accumulated, and it was a fairly equal distribution with only the captain and the quartermaster usually getting a little bit more. It also, the pirate's code had a early form of workman's compensation. If a pirate were to lose a leg or an arm or their eye, they would be eligible for maybe 300, 600 pieces of eight to compensate them for the loss they incurred by being a pirate. So it was a fascinating little culture that pirates created on their ships to maintain some form of cohesion and also, most importantly, to determine ahead of the fact how they would distribute the treasure that they collected.
How big would a typical pirate ship have been during the golden era of piracy? Was there a wide disparity between ship sizes and styles, or was there a fairly common model or size?
There was a wide range because it depended on what ship they initially were able to obtain. There's one pirate that left from New York, a guy named Charles Worley, who started out in pretty much a rowboat with just two other guys, and then he attacked the
just kept scaling up.
And he went up the line. Most of the pirate ships that we know about were probably sloops on the order of maybe 60 or 70 feet long. They had usually ports for some cannons or some kind of armaments. But there were some pirates who attacked larger ships, brigantines, snows, and they could be well over 100 feet. Some of them sported up to 24 or even 40 cannons, but those were the very largest. Pirates didn't want to have ships that were too large because they needed to have very fast ships and ships that could sneak in and out of bays and rivers and sort of escape any pursuers that might be coming after them.
So they were more into mobility necessarily than having a huge ship. Plus, it would take a lot of resources to keep it going.
Yeah, a lot of resources. But pirate ships were very heavily crewed. Let's say that you had a sloop, a fishing sloop, that was 50 or 60 feet long. You might only have 12 crewmen or even fewer to man that ship. But a pirate ship, there's one pirate ship of Stede Bonnet that was only about 70 feet long. It was a sloop, and at one point it had well over 100 pirates on board. Just imagine how crowded that must have
been. Yeah, no doubt. If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Eric J. Dolan, author of Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. We're not taking calls during this part of the show, but if you want to make a comment, you can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or at Twitter. We're at WGCU. So you've written books about a lot of different topics. What brought you to pirates for this?
Yeah, right. I've written 13 books, and they're on widely ranging topics. Almost all the books are on topics that I know little about before I start working on them.
It looks like fun. I mean, you have a really interesting spectrum of topics, I have to say.
Thanks. I appreciate that. It has been fun. But for the pirate book, there was a very specific beginning, and I have to give credit to my two teenage children, or their teenagers at the time, Lily and Harry. I was pitching a couple of ideas to them, and when I mentioned pirates, their eyes lit up, and they said, "That's it, Dad. You have to write about pirates." And I got really excited because neither of my kids have read any of my books. So I figure this was my one big chance, and I'm happy to report that after the book came out, my daughter Lily, who's a senior in college, did read it, and she enjoyed it. My son, who's a freshman in college, has not read it yet, but he's committed to reading it maybe in the next few decades, so I was 50% successful.
That's great. Okay, well, let's just talk a little bit about sort of, you know, is there a most notable or infamous or famous pirate or pirates from that era? I mean, we hear names like, you know, Blackbeard and things like that. Are those real people, and are they who would be considered the most famous?
Yeah, well, the most famous is different from the most successful. Blackbeard is probably the most famous pirate, right up there with Captain William Kidd. And Blackbeard or Edward Thatch was certainly a real pirate, but he had a very short career. It lasted less than 2 years. He wasn't particularly successful in terms of amassing a huge amount of treasure. He did have a small pirate fleet of up to 5 ships at one time and 400 men under his command, and he certainly scared the heck out of the American colonies, especially when he blockaded Charleston Harbor for the better part of a week. But he's most famous, I think, partly because of his name and partly because of a famous book that was written in 1724 called The General History of Pirates that painted him out to be this absolutely fearsome character who went into battle with flames shooting out from under his hat, and he was supposed to be this vicious person. But the reality of Blackbeard is that he certainly didn't go into battle with flames coming out of his head, and he wasn't particularly vicious. He's only known to have whipped one of the victims that he encountered, and then the only other time that he was really violent was at the very end of his life when British Lieutenant Robert Maynard and his men cornered Blackbeard and his men off Ocracoke Island. They had a massive running battle, and Blackbeard was ultimately killed, and his head was severed, and it was hung from the bowsprit of Lieutenant Maynard's sloop. And then, according to legend, they pitched Blackbeard's head over the headless body over the side of the sloop into the murky waters of Pamlico Sound, where it supposedly swam a few laps around the sloop before sinking from sight. So he benefited from a lot of good public relations, in a sense.
He won the branding game.
Yeah, that he didn't necessarily deserve. And Captain William Kidd, of course, he's famous mostly because people think that he buried treasure everywhere from Delaware to Oak Island, Nova Scotia. Unfortunately, that is a total myth. There's no pirate during the Golden Age that was known to have buried any treasure.
Ah.
And Captain Kidd certainly didn't. Another pirate that's not perhaps as well known, but is probably one of the most successful, is Henry Avery, one of the Red Sea pirates. He plundered one of the Emperor Aurangzeb's largest ships and got away with hundreds of thousands of pounds sterling worth of treasure and actually disappeared into the countryside of Ireland, never to be found again. So he apparently lived out his life benefiting from his own riches.
You know, this is a crazy question, but do you think that, I mean, can you imagine what they would have thought that we're still talking about them today? I mean, you know, like Blackbeard, I mean, he would probably have loved to have thought that, you know, 300 years later, we're still having a conversation about him.
I think you're absolutely right. I think they would have gotten a big kick out of it if they could see what's become of their reputation.
Huh. So what was happening here in like the Gulf of Mexico during that golden era of piracy off the coast of Southwest Florida? We have an island here, Gasparilla Island, which is presumably named after Jose Gaspar, who was, the lore says he was a local pirate. Do you know anything about what was going on here?
My book sort of focuses on the late 1600s through 1726, and there wasn't much taking place off of the Florida coast other than one major event where a Spanish treasure fleet sank pretty close to Vero Beach in 1715. And when that treasure fleet, when news of that treasure fleet sinking radiated out to the Atlantic, thousands of people came down to that spot to sink, to dive on the fleet to try to find treasure. And many of them were unsuccessful, but whether successful or not, a lot of them stayed in the area and went down to the Caribbean and became pirates. There was a lot of piracy off the around the Keys and in the Gulf of Mexico, of course, in the early 1800s, which I don't deal with. That's the time of Jean Lafitte and a lot of Spanish piracy that was taking place in your neck of the woods. And part of the reason that the American Navy was sent down there to try to clean things up. But unfortunately, in my book, there's not a lot about piracy taking place off the Florida coast. Anne Bonny, one of the few women pirates, only two that were active during the Golden Age, she was part of Calico Jack Rackham's crew, which did have some activity not far from the southern tip of Florida. But I only talk about her briefly in the book just to highlight the fact that there were very few women on board pirate ships during this time.
That was going to be one of my questions. And then another question is was there an intersection between the world of piracy and the slave trade from Africa?
Yes. There are a couple of ways that it intersected, one of which is a lot of times pirates would take over ships that were slavers. And, of course, on board those ships, if they hadn't already sold their slaves, there would be plenty of slaves. And evidence shows that many African slaves were taken on board pirate ships, and where they continued to serve their new pirate masters and were later resold. However, there is also plenty of evidence that many black men did not remain slaves once they were on board pirate ships, but instead became valued fellow crew members of the pirates, and they shared equally in the booty. Another way that the slave trade got very entangled in piracy was during the era of the Red Seamen. The Red Seamen, when they were operating in the Indian Ocean, they would repair to St. Marie's, a small island off of Madagascar, and that was sort of their home base in the Indian Ocean. But the slave traders and merchants of New York and other American colonies would send ships to St. Marie to sell goods to the pirates. And the people on St. Marie, some of whom were pirates or associated with pirates, were active in gathering up slaves and selling them to these American colonial merchants. And then the slaves would be transported back to the colonies and sold. So there were some intersections between the slave trade and piracy.
Does probably not, but you know, does modern day piracy, like what's going on off the coast of Somalia, does that fall within your purview as someone interested in the world, or is that a whole different chapter?
Well, it's a whole different chapter in terms of the book. The book ends in 1700.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But I find it fascinating. I mentioned Somali pirates at the beginning of the book just to point out specifically to the reader so they're not disabused later on in the book that I don't talk about Somali pirates. And
right.
There are some similarities. Somali pirates, like the pirates of the Golden Age, oftentimes were driven into piracy because of economic dislocation. You know, pirates of the Golden Age often felt that they didn't have another equally viable alternative to make a living, so they went into piracy. And, of course, Somalia and this past summer, Venezuelan piracy, which really took off, was partly fueled by the economic freefall that both of those countries are experiencing. Another parallel between the piracy of the Golden Age and Somali piracy is that in some cases they can be quite violent and they kill or injure some of their victims. But one big difference is the pirates of the Golden Age never, other than one example, which is Blackbeard blockading Charleston Harbor, they never really held victims hostage and waited to be paid off. But that's, of course, the modus operandi of Somali pirates, and was a similar way of operating for the Barbary pirates in the late 1700s and early 1800s, which caused so much trouble to the new United States, and finally, which Thomas Jefferson sent ships over to sort of beat them into submission and tell them to stop taking American ships hostage. because we were a proud and powerful nation, and we weren't going to take it anymore. So there are some parallels, but there are many differences.
Real quick, we've only got a couple minutes left here, but what's the deal with young Benjamin Franklin and piracy?
Well, young Benjamin Franklin, he was an assistant to his older brother James, who was a printer and publisher of the Hartford Courant. And Benjamin Franklin was very witty, even when he was quite young, and he often would write up little songs or ditties that would be sold as broadsides on the streets of Boston, Philadelphia, and other cities in the United States. And after Blackbeard was dispatched by Lieutenant Robert Maynard, Benjamin Franklin wrote a song about the end of Blackbeard that apparently sold quite well on the streets. His father didn't approve of him writing these things, and fortunately for us, he didn't go on to become a poet, which at one time he had thought about doing, but he became one of our greatest statesmen. But the strangest thing about that little ditty about Blackbeard's demise is that not a single copy of it has ever been found, although Benjamin Franklin did write about it in his autobiography, and there are other references to it from contemporary literature. So if anybody has a song about Blackbeard written by Benjamin Franklin in their attic, it would be worth a mint.
So you've written, like I alluded to before, you've written about things like lighthouses, the fur trade, the history of whaling in America, you know, when America first met China. So what is next for you as an author?
Well, this is very appropriate given where you are located. I am currently working on a book, a narrative history of hurricanes in America.
Oh, there you go. A narrative history of hurricanes. What does that mean?
Well, I start with Christopher Columbus, the first Westerner or European to encounter what we consider a Caribbean or a Western Atlantic hurricane. And I take you up through the present. Of course, I can't highlight every hurricane. I just look at some of the major ones. But since it's a narrative story, it essentially uses hurricanes as a backbone to tell a story about American history and the evolution of our experience with hurricanes, our understanding, scientific understanding of hurricanes, and how we have dealt with them over time, and also how they've changed or affected the course of American history.
Well, we will definitely have to have you back on the show when that comes out, so we'll keep in touch. Any final thoughts today?
No, even though I dispel some of the myths of piracy, I want to assure your listeners that it's a fun book, it's a popular history, it's not an academic read, and I hope they give it a shot.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guest, Eric J. Dolan. His latest book is Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. Thank you very much for your time, Eric. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to our earlier guests during our real estate snapshot segment, David Cobb with Metro Study, Brad Dohack with Gulf Point Properties, and Denny Grimes from Denny Grimes & Company. Our show today was produced by Julie Glenn and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thank you for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.